This is Nancy Clare, and welcome to the 95th episode of Speaking of Mysteries. In this episode, Les Klinger and I talk to Reed Farrell Coleman, whose Robert B. Parker's Debt to Pay, the next installment of the story of Jesse Stone, is being published today, September 13, 2016. We talk about all manner of things, how Robert B. Parker felt about Tom Selleck's portrayal of Jesse Stone, Reed's new series featuring Gus Murphy, and putting his previous character, Mo Prager, on the shelf. Instead of our usual intro, our conversation starts with Reed talking about a favorite quote of his from Jonathan Lethem's Motherless Brooklyn. Here's Reed Farrell Coleman.
Well, you know, Jonathan Lethem is famous for my favorite quote of his is, about the Gowanus Canal in Brooklyn is that it's the only body of water on Earth that's 90% guns.
Which is a great lead-in to talk about your series
guns.
Of books, both the ones you write under your own name and the ones you write under Robert B. Parker's.
Sure.
So... the most recent of which is coming out next week, Debt to Pay, starring Jesse Stone.
Officially, it's Robert B. Parker's Debt to Pay.
By Reed.
His name is actually always part of the title.
Did you study, I am fascinated knowing that Parker actually wrote, you probably read his master's thesis. About Philip Marlowe and Sherlock Holmes and all that stuff.
I have never read his thesis.
It's online. You should Google it under Google Scholars, I think. And it's amazing to me. He was actually, it was preparatory to his writing career. And he did this research into the classic detective, and then quite deliberately, I think, created Spencer sort of based.
It was quite deliberate.
Now you wrote a nonfiction essay about Parker as well, and others as well.
Well, I think it's called "Go East, Young Man," Jesse Stone, Robert B. Parker, and Spencer, or something to that effect. And that's how I thought I got the gig.
So was that only about Parker? Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Is that how you got the gig? You're not sure.
It was my assumption that that's how I got the gig. In the first conversation I had with my editor, I said, so you've read the essay? And she said, what essay? And I said, you know, Go East, Young Man, Jesse Stone, Robert B. Parker, and Spencer. And she said, no, I've never read that. So... you know, that's what happens when you make assumptions. So actually how I got the gig was apparently that my editor, who was Robert B. Parker's editor for 20 years, had always been a fan of my work. And when they decided to part ways with the gentleman who was currently writing the series, she suggested me to the estate, and that's how I got the gig.
Your Jesse Stone reminds me a little bit of Mo Prager, one of your other characters. Am I wrong in thinking that, or is it just because they're both sort of remind me, they're biblical. They remind me of Job.
Well, I can't tell you what your opinion is right or wrong. I don't write Jesse like Mo. For one thing, Mo is written in first person, and he's a PI, and he's, you know, fundamentally a different type of character than Jesse Stone. Mo is the kind of guy who wore his heart on his sleeve, and I like to say about Jesse Stone is the only thing he wears on his sleeve is his sleeve. He is not a very externally expressive person. But I do think that what is the fun of crime fiction writing if you don't put your characters through a lot? I believe in high stakes. So in that sense, I think there is a similarity. And there will always be a similarity in my books because there's usually a high emotional payoff or risk in the books.
Let me ask you, why did you want to write Jesse Stone? I mean, I can understand somebody who, I think of you as already having a great national presence. You've been nominated for, you know, a dozen awards, et cetera. Why did you want to write the Jesse Stone books?
It pays well. I mean, I had some profile, some national profile, but nothing will help your profile like getting on the bestseller list. And it was a challenge, and I love challenges in writing. I always like to tell people that I like to think that there isn't any type of thing that you could put in front of me that I wouldn't be able to write. So it was a great challenge to me. And, you know, Jesse's an interesting character, and I wanted to see if I could both keep him the same, yet have him be a little different.
You were obviously a fan before you...
I was definitely more of a fan of Jesse Stone than of Spencer. But I wouldn't say that I was a Parker devotee.
Did you ever meet him?
I met him once. I met him... Do you remember Kate's Mystery Books in Cambridge? There was a great mystery bookstore in Cambridge on Massachusetts Avenue. And the woman who owned the store, Kate Mattis, who won the Raven Award, I think, a few years ago, used to have a Christmas party every year. And she would invite all of the Boston area writers and a lot of the New York area writers to come up to her store for this Christmas party. And it was at her Christmas parties that I met Dennis Lehane and Linda Barnes and Hank Ryan and Hallie Efron. And one of the people I met at the party was Bob Parker. Of course, he had no clue who I was, and that's fine. But he was such a gentleman. We spent about 5 minutes talking to each other. Seemed like a really nice man.
I'm kind of with you on that. Jesse Stone was always and continues to be my favorite of the two characters because things don't always go his way, or they rarely go his way.
Well, if you read the essay that I had written about Jesse Stone, Parker, I did some research on this, Parker actually was tired of writing a perfect character. Like, he considered Spencer to be the perfect character. You know, he's smart, he knows a lot, he is, you know, rugged, he's handsome, things go right for Spencer. I mean, it doesn't mean he's not challenged, but things go right for Spencer. Whereas I believe, wanted to write a more imperfect character, and Jesse Stone was his attempt at an imperfect character.
Well, he certainly has a lot of baggage, Jesse. You know, he does indeed. He's still mourning his, you know, what he considers his lost chance at the bigs in baseball, and to say he has trouble with his romantic life is an understatement. And you go into that a lot in Debt to Pay.
Yeah. Jesse, you know, it's funny when you pick up and write someone else's character, you have to find a doorway, or at least I did. I had to find a doorway into Jesse. Now, one of the things that I found as a doorway into Jesse was baseball, because I'm a huge baseball fan. And so that was one of the ways I found into Jesse. Another thing that I think that people who read the series really understand this, is what makes a character relatable and human is his or her struggles. And Jesse has, you know, two big struggles. He struggles with alcohol, and he struggles with having a meaningful, long-lasting relationship with women. I mean, he has all the women in the world. They all seem to love him, but he really has trouble having kind of a serious, long-lasting relationship with them. And, you know, all of us struggle. Some of us struggle with alcohol. Some of us struggle with drugs. Some of us struggle with our weight, with our relationships, with any number of things. But the people relate to Jesse so much because they see that he struggles.
In I think, biblical terms, like I said, I always think of Job when I read a Jesse Stone novel.
Yeah, well, you know, S.J. Roseanne once said that I should have called Mo Prager Job and not Mo. Because I do like to burden my characters.
Well, so now you've got more than one. You've got Jesse to burden, you got Mo to burden, you got Joe Serpy. Are you doing more Joe Serpy stories?
No more Joe Serpys, and I probably no more Mo's.
But you have Gus Murphy now.
I do have poor Gus, who is another Job figure.
Who's also going to be sort of a Long Island guy.
He's one of the reasons that Putnam went for this series is that it was set on Long Island, but not the Long Island that everybody thinks about when they think about Long Island. This is the inglorious Long Island where most of us live.
So neither the North Shore nor the South Shore?
No, it's neither. It's you know, as Gus says, when people think about Long Island, they think about the gilded coastline. They think about Great Neck. They think about the Gold Coast. They think about the Hamptons. They think about the Five Towns, but they never think about the people who live this side or that side of the Long Island Expressway, and that's where most of us live.
So it's a book about Huntington Station and Iceland.
Exact. Huntington Station features quite prominently in the first Gus Murphy book, Where It Hurts.
Why did you decide to wrap up the Mo series, Reed?
Because for two or three reasons. One, I had said about everything I had to say through Mo. Mo is a great character, but I had said everything I had to say through him. And secondly, to use this joke again, the only thing, you know, it was a hard-boiled series, and at Mo's age, the only thing he could flash with any credibility was his ARP card. So I had no interest in making him the Altacaca detective and moving him down to Boca Raton to, you know, get people's walkers back or their hearing aids back. So I had, you know, he.
So how is Gus going to be different?
Gus is fundamentally a different type of character than Mo. Mo was a guy who was a cynical New York Jew. I mean, that's who I am, and that's who Mo was. So even from birth, he kind of had a jaundiced view of the world. You know, when bad things happened to Mo, he didn't go, oh, my God, how could this happen to me? He said, of course they happened to me. Gus, on the other hand, is a guy who assumed, because he had everything he ever wanted. He had a lovely wife, a beautiful family, a house, a great pension. He was a guy who assumed, hey, the universe is a good place, and I understand how this works. And when something happened, terrible happened to him, his reaction was not, oh, of course this happened to me. It was, how could this happen? How could this happen in a universe I understand? So he is actually fundamentally a different character than Mo was.
Les and I have talked about this before with writers of series, that there's a tyranny to a series, and it seems like you have effectively been able to end one and begin another. Have you gotten hate mail from your fans about putting Mo literally and figuratively on the shelf?
No, people have written and expressed, you know, sadness that Mo is on the shelf, but they feel that the way I put him on the shelf was a very fitting ending. No one has said, oh, my God, how could you end the series that way? People have expressed sadness that there won't be any more books, but none of them have... I have not gotten one complaint about how I ended the series.
So no one's railing Deaf Heaven with bootless cries about it.
No, well, no one is threatening murder or you know, knocking down my door. No one's complaining that bitterly.
And the Jesse series is going to continue. So
as they keep paying me, it's going to continue.
Well, you've left Jesse in a place that sort of opens up. There has to be a follow-up to how Debt to Pay ended.
Yes. Well, I'm now editing that book. I am about 20 pages away from finishing editing the follow-up book, which is called Robert B. Parker's The Hangman's Sonnet. And it does pick up a few months after the end of Debt to Pay.
And is it written in iambic pentameter?
Shall I compare them to a summer's day?
No.
No, but I did. What's great is I did get an opportunity to write a sonnet for it. So there is a sonnet in it.
You're a poet. I mean, you really write poetry.
Yeah, I started out actually as a poet. My first published writing is poetry, and that was my first love. But, you know, no one makes a living as a poet.
Well, that's
no one makes a living as a mystery writer. So, it was my first love, and I do like revisiting it every now and then.
I interviewed Sophie Hannah last year, and I asked her about the Venn diagram of poetry and writing mysteries, and she said that the discipline of poetry helped her in structuring mysteries. And so you're the second published poet that we've spoken to that's also written mysteries. So I'm curious if that's a case. Case for you too.
Well, the funny thing is, I had never written, any long piece of fiction in my life until I wrote my first book, which was published, by the way. So, I imagine that my poetry writing helped, but I don't see it as an issue of structure because I never outline. But I see my poetry training as helping in terms of strength of images. Like, one of the things that I think people like about my writing is that there are powerful images in it, and that there is a rhythm to my writing that, you know, no one sits there and counts iambs as they're reading a mystery novel, but there seems to be a pleasant rhythm to my writing. So I would say my writing has benefited not as much from structure, but from strength of image and from meter.
Is it okay to ask if Jesse finds a modicum of happiness in either the Hangman's Sonnet or whatever's to come?
I think Jesse, as he ages, will find some measure of happiness. He's not a totally unhappy person. He is, obviously, we can't give too much away. He has reason to be very unhappy now. But the Hangman's Sonnet is a sort of continuation of that. But I think things are going to change in the series. There are changes coming in the series that will please the old fans and bring in new fans. And I think there's more happiness in Jesse's future.
Was it difficult to write something like Debt to Pay, which is, I mean, it's a really good book and it's a really great story. But it is at its core a sad story, a good mystery and a sad story. Is that a fair...
Yes, yes. But I think it's not all of it is sad, but obviously there's hugely sad elements to it.
No, some of it's actually very blackly funny in a very dark, dark way.
Yeah, in a very sick and twisted way.
Very sick and twisted.
Know, welcome to my world.
Your world is a wonderful place.
Yes. I did not have a difficult time writing it because I had that book pretty much when I had the idea for it. It was one of those books that kind of appeared whole in my head. You know, I knew what was going to happen, kind of when it was going to happen, as opposed to some books where I sit down and I just have the basic idea for it and I just start writing.
Well, so I was going to ask, first of all, Reed, you know the answer to this better than anybody else. Does Jesse Stone really look like Tom Selleck?
Well, I will give you the best answer I possibly can. One of the things that's great about getting this gig is that Robert B. Parker's best and oldest friend is still alive. And his name is Mel Farman. And Mel, when you get the gig, and you come to Boston, he takes you to Legal Seafood, where he and Bob Parker used to eat every week. And there's a plaque by the bar to Robert B. Parker. And Mel said, and, you know, I have no reason to disbelieve Mel. Mel said that Bob Parker got emotional the first time he saw Tom Selleck playing Jesse Stone because he thought he was perfect for the part.
Well, that's great. That's wonderful.
So better than what I think? Yeah, it's better than what I think. You know, you have it kind of from the horse's mouth.
Switching gears completely here. You spent, you were crazy enough to take on the job of executive vice president of MWA. And I wanted to talk a little bit about MWA. And I know you're really proud of the MWA University. And, you know, this is, we get a lot of listeners who are writers. We also get a lot of listeners who are hoping to be writers. Tell us a little bit, Reed, about your I know you're still deeply involved with MWA. Tell us a little bit about your vision about MWA and what it does for writers and why you devoted all this energy to it.
Well, what's funny, Les, is I've never been a joiner in my life. I've never been a guy to join anything. You know, I wasn't a Boy Scout. I didn't join a fraternity. It's just not my nature to do that stuff. But what I found with MWA was it was like being adopted. I know you know this. I mean, you're as involved in it as I was, still are. It was like getting a family of 3,000 people. It was the most welcomed I ever felt into anything, and felt that I needed to give back. You know, I felt that these people were great to me, and I needed to do my part. And to those writers who complain about, you know, what does MWA do for me? And, you know, we've all heard that complaint. I always say, you get out of it what you put into it. And I find the people who are willing to sacrifice and put stuff into it are the people who get the most out of it. I mean, I can sit here and tell, you know, we can tell stories about the person who came to that first dinner or cocktail party and met an agent. Instead of, sending blind letters to people they've never met, you know, you join MWA and there's an agent there. You know, and that agent may not take you on, but at least you've had some experience in talking to an agent. You've never met a publisher before. Well, you know, you go to an MWA function and you're likely to meet a publisher or an editor or somebody. So I think it's the best possible thing you can do if you're starting out. And it's the best support group in the world. Look, I have nothing against ITW. I was one of the first members of ITW. I love Sisters in Crime. I think all of these organizations are great. But I think if you're starting out and you need encouragement and you want to meet people, I think NWA is great.
And I think it's a great place. When I pitch it at places like the LA Times Festival of Books, one of my spiels is join MWA and hang out with famous mystery writers.
Right.
We have a lot of members that I still remember the first time I ever went to a lunch and I sat down at a table with names that I knew. They weren't big names, but they were all mystery writers that I knew. I was really thrilled. I was also really disappointed to find out that they all had day jobs.
Yes. Yeah, that is that when you find that out, it's kind of crushing at first. But it makes you feel good too, because yes, you're not alone.
Exactly.
I just a quick story. I mean, you know, I was at the LA Times Festival of Books, and I was walking past the old, you know, mystery bookstore booth, and I hear an older woman calling my name, right, and running after me, and I turn around, and it's Mary Higgins Clark. Mary Higgins Clark doesn't have to run after me to say hello to me, but how do I know Mary? I know her through MWA. I mean, that's the thing about MWA that's so cool. In Cleveland, at Cleveland VoucherCon, I was interviewed on TV, and they asked me, you know, what's so great about, you know, VoucherCon or MWA? And I said, you go to a Dodgers game or a Yankees game or a Mets game, you sit in the stands and you root for the team, but you can't really, really have a relationship with the players. But if you want to, you know, you want to have a drink with Lee Child, you want to, you know, meet Mary Higgins Clark, you want to meet Les Klinger, you can meet them. It's the difference is, you know, we're completely accessible, and I think that's a great thing.
I think it's great for people who are trying to learn the craft as well. It's, you know, there are beta reader groups, there are writing groups, there are networking. I mean, it's just, you can actually talk to real writers about how they handle things, whether it's changing agents or finding an agent or whatever. Sisters of Practice is a great job.
It's great emotionally, and the practical knowledge you gain by being an MWA member, I think is priceless. It changed my career.
I think, I don't know who gets credit for this statement. I've always heard it attributed to Michael Connelly about, you know, the success of real of Reed Farrell Coleman doesn't mean that Les Klinger failed as a writer. We all succeed when we all succeed.
Yeah, it's not a zero-sum game. There's not a limited amount of success in the world, and I think that's one of the great things about MWA is we really believe that. You know, it's not just some silly statement that we put out there that none of us believe. I'm happy when people who are my colleagues succeed, because that's good for all of us, and we should cheer people's success and not resent it.
Absolutely. Let me switch topics again. You've co-written, you have collaborated several times in your career on novels, and what's it like? And, you know, is it worth doing? Is it fun?
Collaboration, it's really interesting. I've done it on some projects that haven't, you know, made it to fruition, but I've also done it on two standalone novels, one with Ken Bruin and one with a retired New York City detective named John Rowe. And they were both interesting experiences, but they were difficult experiences. And I think true collaboration...
That's what I was asking about.
Yeah. True collaboration is difficult. The people who do it on a regular basis, like Preston and Child, you know, Preston, I don't know how you do that, because I would find, I don't mind doing it every now and then. It's like everything you do makes you a better writer, but it's much easier writing Jesse Stone with, you know, than it is if I was writing with Bob Parker.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, because when you collaborate.
He doesn't get to say, I don't like that.
Right. The estate does, though. The estate has, you know, final approval. So, but so far, so good. But the fact is, when you're writing with, you know, we're social people, but writers are loners by nature in terms of their writing. You know, it's their thing. This is my style. These are my words. And you have to be able to submerge your ego a little or a lot when you're doing collaboration. And somebody's got to be the boss. And you have to know that from the beginning. And with Ken Bruin, and when Ken and I wrote Tower, he was the boss. And when I wrote the Bronx Requiem with John Rowe, I was the boss.
Well, that's probably good advice. Did you find that you had different writing style than your collaborators? I mean, I don't mean the words. I mean, like, I write from 9 till noon or whatever.
Well, you know, luckily the collaborations we do, when I collaborated with Ken, I like to say, and I'm saying this with a smile on my face, it was a good thing there was an ocean between us, and neither one of us owned a handgun. But what's funny is Ken writes with Jason Starr, and they do it in the same room. They do it in the same room, and you really can't tell which one of them wrote what lines. And so I find that amazing.
Yeah.
Because if Ken and I had written together, I think there would have been, you know, an episode of Murder One there. But because we both are passionate, so passionate, and I don't think either one of us would have done a very good job of submerging our egos enough, it was good we were apart. And it was good we wrote our own parts of the book separately. But it's difficult, and it's not something I would look forward to doing again.
No, I get it. I've done it in a slightly different context. I've done it in editing together. Lori King and I have now done, as you know, 3 anthologies. And, oh, yes, Reed Coleman is writing for our 4th anthology.
Yes, I have to. What's my deadline, by the way?
Oh, January of 18. Can you handle it?
Oh, okay. I'm in. I'm in, baby.
And we're putting together a great crew. Greg Hurwitz just signed on to write a story for us. Our good friend Harley Jane Kozak is going to write a story.
Great.
And so on. So we're going to have fun again.
Yes. I look forward to it.
Well, I was reflecting on it because Lori and I have worked out sort of the who does what in the collaboration, and she's the boss of certain parts, and I'm the boss of certain parts. I'm the boss of things like I write the checks.
It's really important to establish that early on, who does what and who has the final say about this or that.
Reed, is there anything else that we should be talking about with you?
Not necessarily. So far, it's been pretty much fun and comprehensive. So, Les, I'll see you next week.
I will indeed. Looking forward to it. I'll buy you a drink, Reed.
Okay, thanks a lot. It's on tape now, though.
Okay, it's a promise.
Okay, take care.
Bye.